when neuroscience is studied as if the brain is, or as if the mind is just a material product of the brain, well, then it kind of looks like the mind is a material product of the brain, but that's an artifact of the way scientists study it. If scientists open their minds to the existence of the soul, the science is much better science, and the answers become much, much more clear.
This is Global Air Force with your host, Jim Rohn.
Praise God. It is another beautiful day. Thank you for tuning into Global Radio today. I want to share with our radio audience that the brain, the organ of the brain, is not your soul. The organ, the brain, it is not your mind, in the sense that it's not your will, not your motivator, your conscience. Okay.
No, really.
I know I'm getting into deep water right away, but I want you to listen to our program today. It is a collection. If you are a radio listener, you may not go to YouTube and Facebook. And it focuses on Dr. Michael Higner, what he has learned in his many years as a neurosurgeon.
I was brought up kind of in an atheist environment, and I always respected Christianity. I thought it was a lovely story. I thought Christians were really nice people. I just thought it was just a pleasant myth. And I fell in love with science, and I majored in biochemistry in college, and I went on, and I fell in love with neuroscience and medical school and decided to become a neurosurgeon. And I found, as I practiced neurosurgery, that things I was seeing in patients and in patients who had brain conditions didn't really fit the textbooks that I had. And I saw that what was wrong was the materialist perspective that the textbooks took. So it got me to thinking, and many other things in my life moved me to Christ. I would get these things that I called hauntings, which were episodes where I would just start to think, well, what am I doing here? Where did I come from? Where am I going? You know, you get so caught up in everyday life that I felt as though I was missing the big question, and I didn't have any answers to that question. So while this was going through my mind, my youngest son was born, and my wife and I noticed that he wasn't really making really good eye contact as a young infant, and I was afraid that that he was autistic, and the thought that he wouldn't connect to me was really terrifying to me. So we took him to some specialists, got him evaluated. They said they couldn't really be sure, and when he was about 6 months old, I was at a outside Catholic hospital seeing a patient in consultation late at night. And as I was leaving the hospital, I was really having a tough time emotionally. So I stopped by the hospital chapel, and I got in front of the altar and I prayed. And I said, Lord, I don't know if you exist. I rather doubt that you do. But if you do exist, this is something I can't take. I can't have a child who is separate from me in this way. It's something I don't know that I can bear. And I heard a voice, only time in my life I've ever heard a voice. And the voice said, but that's what you're doing to me. And I collapsed. I said, well, I won't do it to you anymore. I'm sorry. I know how it feels now. So the next day I called up the church, said I need to get baptized like fast as possible. A couple days later was my son's 6 month birthday, and I came home from work, and he was perfectly normal, making eye contact, smiling, a normal baby. So I realized that the Lord had shown me what I was doing to Him, and He wanted me to be closer to Him. So I've spent many years now trying to get closer to Him and to help people see that Christ is the answer. Christ is the way. Medical textbooks that I had studied described the brain as if it were a computer, and they were all kind of materialistically oriented. And I had patients who were missing major parts of their brains, and all neurosurgeons have this experience. And a lot of them were really in pretty good shape. I had a little girl born missing about 2/3 of her brain. The rest of her head was mostly water. And I told her family that I didn't think she was going to do very well. And I followed her as she grew up. She's currently in her mid-20s, and she's a perfectly normal person. She's actually rather bright. And I have a number of patients like that. That doesn't mean that everybody who's got problems with their brain is going to be okay. But there are many people who are okay. And it really struck me. At one point, I was doing an operation on a woman who had a brain tumor in her left frontal lobe, and we had to do it with her awake, which we do occasionally. And we use local anesthesia, so there's no pain. And I had to map the surface of her brain to find out where her speech area was located, because the tumor was very close to it, and I had to remove part of her brain that had the tumor embedded in it. And I was talking with her as I did this, and it was a surreal experience. I mean, I'm taking out a major part of the left frontal lobe of her brain as I'm having a conversation with her about the weather and about her family and about the hospital cafeteria food and so on. And it struck me that none of the textbooks said anything about this. The textbook made it sound as though the brain is just a computer. And obviously, if you remove a major part of your computer, it's not going to work very well. But she was doing just fine. And so I came to realize from that and from doing a lot of research, looking in the medical literature, that there's a part of our mind that is not in the brain, that we have souls. There's an immaterial aspect to us. Roughly half the brain is what we would call eloquent brain. And eloquent brain means parts of the brain that you really need. And if there's any damage to them, you get serious trouble. You can have a stroke, brain injury, things like that. But there are other parts of the brain, about half the brain, that are not eloquent at all, and that one can damage or remove without any significant effect on a person's life. You can even cut a person's brain in half, which occasionally is done surgically to treat seizures. People are pretty normal after that. And there's been a lot of research done on this. So the brain, in many ways, is not like a computer. And the mind is not like computation. And there's a part of the mind that really fits the model of a soul better than it fits the model of a computer. First of all, the concept of the mind is a pretty modern concept. Classical philosophers and so on didn't really think in terms of the mind. They thought in terms of the soul. And what I think is the most reasonable, most accurate way of understanding what a soul is Thomas Aquinas' way of understanding it, which is basically Aristotle's, which is that the soul is not some spooky, translucent thing that looks like you, but you can see through it, stuff like that. The soul is just everything that we do that makes us alive. So our soul is the set of activities that make us living human beings. So my ability to speak is part of my soul. My heartbeat is part of my soul. My breathing is part of my soul. My vision is part of my soul. The mind, as we understand it now, really is just several of those powers. That is, the mind is the ability to perceive, to move, to remember, to think abstractly. And some of those powers are linked to the brain in very tight ways. But other powers, like the intellect and the free will, are not linked to the brain in a tight way. And I think that's the way the soul works. And that's the way that Thomas Aquinas felt the soul worked. And one of the things that utterly amazes me about modern neuroscience is that if you wanted a roadmap as to the way the mind works, you read Thomas Aquinas. I mean, he lays it out, and the neuroscience strongly supports what he saw in the 13th century. Roger Scruton, who's a philosopher, I think he passed away recently, but was a wonderful philosopher, made a comment about neuroscience, and I paraphrase, but that I think gets to the heart of a lot of the interpretive problems we face in neuroscience. And Scruton said that neuroscience is a vast trove of answers with no memory of the questions. That is, we have to be very careful about what we're looking for and the way we view our science from a philosophical perspective, or we just consistently get the wrong interpretations of what we find. And Werner Heisenberg, who's a famous physicist who was instrumental in the development of quantum mechanics back about 100 years ago, had a deep insight when he said that what we observe is not nature herself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning. So that when neuroscience is studied as if the brain is, or as if the mind is just a material product of the brain, well, then it kind of looks like the mind is a material product of the brain, but that's an artifact of the way scientists study it. If scientists open their minds to the existence of the soul, the science is much better science and the answers become much, much more clear. A number of different neurosurgeons beginning in the 1940s, and the research that was done on that was by a guy named Roger Sperry, who was a neuroscientist who worked in the mid-20th century, who actually won the Nobel Prize for his work on that. There are certain kinds of seizures, relatively rare, that begin as a tiny focus in one side of the brain, and then they jump across to the other hemisphere of the brain through a big bundle of fibers called the corpus callosum, which is about the size of the palm of your hand. Hmm. And that would cause a major seizure. And it was discovered in the 1940s that if you cut the corpus callosum, it would stop that kind of seizure from happening and give these people a lot better lives. And the surgery was done, and what was found, and I've done the surgery, that postoperatively these people are really normal people. Their brain hemispheres are almost completely separated, and but they feel like one person. They don't become two people. They're not two centers of consciousness. They're amazingly normal. So Roger Sperry, this neuroscientist, studied them in great detail, and he found ways that he could present images to each one of the hemispheres independently. And he did find some slight perceptual abnormalities in these people. They're very subtle, and the research was so beautiful that he won the Nobel Prize for it. But the amazing thing, I think, and even Sperry commented on this, is how little a difference cutting the brain in half makes. And particularly, and there's been recent research that's looked into this in much more detail, what people find is that splitting the brain in half splits some aspects of our perception, like our visual perception, but it doesn't split consciousness. It doesn't split our sense of self. It doesn't split our ability to think abstractly. That all remains unified, which implies that there is an aspect of the mind, which is the soul, that can't be split with a knife. You can split certain things because the brain is certainly an organ that's involved in some aspects of the mind, but not other things. A wonderful example of this that actually gives me chills. This is a fascinating work. It's done by Alice Cronin at MIT. And what she's done is using certain techniques can take split brain patients. And into one hemisphere, she shows a picture. To the other hemisphere, she shows three pictures, and she asks the person to match which of the three pictures conceptually matches the one picture in the opposite hemisphere. And for example, one of the things she uses is a picture of an artist palette in one hemisphere, and then a picture of a violin, a toilet plunger, and an electric light bulb in the other hemisphere. And she says, which one of those three pictures matches the other picture? And most people will pick the violin because an artist palette and a violin are both artistic things. But there's no part of the patient's brain that has seen both of those sets of pictures. One hemisphere sees the artist palette, one hemisphere sees the violin, but no part of the brain sees both, but the people can connect them. The people say, oh, those two match. So the question is, what part of the person's mind is able to compare the two things? Because it's not the brain. The brain can't see both. One part of the brain sees one. The other part of the brain sees the other. They're not connected anymore. So that what that implies is that there is an aspect of the mind that is not material, that is part of the soul, that can integrate these things that come from different brain regions that are no longer connected. Conjoined twins, I think, tell us quite a bit about how the mind works. who are young ladies who were born with basically attached at the head, and they share a connection between their brains. And they've been studied in some depth. And for example, they can see through each other's eyes. They can feel each other's skin. If a mother touches one child's leg, the other child also knows that the leg is being touched. And they share some memories. But interestingly enough, they're completely different people. That is, they have different personalities. They have different opinions about things. Clearly, I think what we're seeing there is that there are two different souls, two different distinct human beings who do share some mental abilities, but they don't share all mental abilities, and they're still completely distinct. And it's a fascinating thing. The conjoined twins, I think, tell us quite a bit about how the mind works.
Dr. Agnor, you said this: the brain is the organ of movement, perception, memory, and emotion. There is no organ of intellect and will. Please comment on that.
Yes, and it's as you mentioned, it's a really nice synopsis. First of all, it's a nice synopsis of Thomistic psychology. It's St. Thomas's understanding of the soul, and neuroscience really demonstrates it. The brain is an organ just like any other organ. That is, the heart has a job, it pumps blood. The kidneys have a job, they make urine. Every organ does its thing. The brain's an organ, it's a piece of meat. And it has, it really has five things. One thing it does is it regulates homeostasis, meaning it keeps our blood pressure normal, keeps our heartbeat normal, stuff like that. It allows us to move. It allows us to have sensations. It allows us to have memories, and it allows us to have emotions. But the neuroscience makes it very clear, I think, that intellect, the capacity for reasoning, for abstract thought, and free will don't come from the brain. They don't come from any meat. They're not from an organ. They're powers of our soul. But those powers of our soul are immaterial. And because they're immaterial, they're spiritual. We have spiritual souls, and because they're immaterial, also they can't die. That is, that you things that are not matter can't disintegrate at the time of death. So that points to the immortality of our souls, which I think is also demonstrated by neuroscience.
So how then, if the brain is not the organ of the intellect, how is it then that people that have brain injuries have problems maybe expressing themselves or thinking, if in fact they do? How does that work?
It has to do with the difference between necessity and sufficiency. When you see a correlation between things, for example, the brain and the exercise of, say, the brain and the exercise of vision, you can ask, first of all, is the brain necessary for the normal exercise of vision? And the answer is yes. If your brain isn't working right, you can have visual problems. Is it sufficient for vision? And the answer is also yes, meaning that if you've got a good brain, you can see. With the intellect and will, is the brain necessary for the normal exercise of intellect and will? Yes, right. I mean, if you drink too much alcohol, your will isn't going to be the same as when you're sober. And if you get hit on the head with a bat, your intellect isn't going to be the same as when you're sober. But is the brain sufficient for the intellect and will? And there's a ton of neuroscientific evidence that it's not sufficient for it. That is, in a sense, the brain enables us to exercise our intellect and will normally, but the intellect and will don't come from the brain.
I think you may have found that in the part of the book where you talked about people who are in a deep coma, a vegetative state. Can you describe that, Dr. Edmund?
Yeah, it's fascinating work, just landmark work. It was originally done by Adrian Owen, who was a neuroscientist at Cambridge, England, back about 20 years ago. There's a particular kind of severe brain damage called persistent vegetative state that is actually deeper than coma, meaning it was believed by the medical profession that it was a state where a person had such enormous brain damage that there was no mind at all. This person was just a body, just a shell. And it's just one step above brain death. And what Owen did is he took a patient, it's been done on many patients since then, he put her in an MRI machine and did something called functional MRI imaging, which can let you know what's happening inside the brain as a person thinks and does things. And he asked her questions, like imagine you're playing tennis, imagine you walk across the room. And he found that areas of her very badly damaged brain lit up in certain patterns. So he put normal people in the machine and did the same thing, and the same areas lit up. So it was as if she was understanding what he was saying. And then what he did is he scrambled the words so that the same noises were coming in to her ears, but they didn't make any sense and nothing lit up. So what he showed was that she was understanding what he was saying, even in the deepest level of coma. And other people have studied this, and they found that you can, for some people in persistent vegetative state, you can converse with them. You can talk about their family. You can talk about, they can tell you things about what's happened in their life. There are people who can do a little bit of mathematics in persistent vegetative state using this imaging technique. So what it shows us is that there's a disconnect between the brain. In these patients, the brain is massively damaged, nearly destroyed. And the capacity to have abstract thought, the capacity to use reason, to form concepts. And that disconnection shows up again and again in neuroscience. And it shows up in the work with persistent vegetative state as well.
So while their lack of a brain may affect their movement, perception, memory, and emotion.
Precisely.
Their intellect and will is not as affected as much.
It seems that way, yes, yes. Okay. And which has always been a question that I've had about persistent vegetative state. When your brain is massively damaged, you can't communicate, you can't talk, right. You can't move. So how do we know what's going on inside the mind? Because the only way that a person knows what's going on inside another person's mind anyway is just behavior, and brain damage damages behavior. And what Owen showed is that the mind, in many cases, kind of keeps going. Near-death experiences, first of all, are fairly common. About at least 9 million Americans have had some kind of near-death or out-of-body experience. That's pretty well established. And about 20% of those experiences involve accurate perceptions that take place during a time when the brain is not functioning. Probably the most famous near-death experience was of a woman named Pam Reynolds, who was a lady who had an aneurysm at the base of her brain. And required a very radical kind of brain operation to fix the aneurysm, called a standstill procedure. It was done in Phoenix by Robert Spetzler, who was a neurosurgeon there who specialized in this back in 1991. And what Spetzler had to do was he had to cool her body down to the operating room under general anesthesia to about 60 degrees Fahrenheit to protect her brain, then to put her on a heart-lung machine, then to stop her heart and stop the blood flowing to her brain, then to tilt the operating table up so the blood drained out of her brain, and then fix the aneurysm. The aneurysm was in a blood vessel, and he had to repair the blood vessel, open it, and fix it without blood flowing through it. And he had about 30 minutes before she would have permanent brain damage. And he did the surgery. It worked very well. She was tested meticulously. She had they tested her brain waves, and she was clearly completely brain dead. I mean, there wasn't even any blood inside her brain. Her heart wasn't beating. And after the surgery, she told Dr. Spetzler that she watched the whole operation. She said that as soon as her heart stopped beating, that she felt a pop and she felt herself coming out of her body. She rose up to the ceiling of the operating room over Spetzler's shoulder, watched him operate. She described to him in detail about his surgical instruments. She described his conversations word for word that he had. She described what the other doctors said and did during the operation. She knew intimate details of the surgery. Then she said she went down a tunnel. At the other end of the tunnel, she saw deceased relatives. They told her she had to go back and raise her kids. She had three kids. She couldn't stay on the other side. She went back down the tunnel. And she said that going back into her body was like diving into a pool of ice water, which is true because her body temperature was 60 degrees. So she's a very well-documented case of near-death experiences. And people who have near-death experiences have these remarkable things happen to them. And when I've discussed this with skeptics, and there are many materialists out there who are skeptical of the reality of these experiences, I point out that there are four aspects of near-death experiences that a skeptic has to explain. One is that people who have these experiences have crystal clear thoughts, very detailed, high-level thoughts that are not characteristic of somebody who has a dying brain. Second of all, that they have out-of-body experiences very often that occur when their brain is not working. That is, when their heart is stopped, their brain is not functioning, but they can see what's going on. They see details around them. They actually say that their perceptions are more accurate, are more comprehensive than when they were in their body. Also, something that really fascinates me is that when people go down the tunnel and they meet people at the other end of the tunnel, as far as I know, in every recorded instance, the people they meet are dead. Mm. That is, you don't meet living people at the other end of the tunnel. It's not like wishful thinking, like you would like to see your wife and you see her at the other end to comfort you, but she's still alive. And there have been a number of reports of people who see people at the other end of the tunnel who are dead that they didn't know were dead.
Mm.
People who had someone who passed away, they didn't know they passed away, but they met them at the tunnel. And near-death experiences are transformative. People really, it transforms people's lives. So for skeptics, I challenge them with these four characteristics of near-death experiences, because I think at least in a certain subset of people, these experiences are very real, and they indicate that the soul is not the same thing as the body.
Mike, can you kind of summarize it for us and give us the personal impact of this on our listeners?
Yeah, I think it's very important to understand that we have immortal souls, that there's an aspect to us that is spiritual. And the human soul is a spirit, and the human spirit is a soul. We're really spiritual creatures that are who are embodied. And it means a lot. It's not just a scientific or philosophical observation. It's a very practical thing. It means, for example, that everything we do has reverberations in eternity. That we are eternal creatures, and people we deal with are eternal creatures, and everything we do matters. Right? Things don't go away when we die. That we continue living, and it's important to live this life the way we are intended to live this life. And I think the way we're intended is the way God intends us to live this life. It also tells us a lot about the sanctity of human life.
You've been trying hard to make it all alone, trying hard to make it all your own, and the strength you once were feeling isn't there no more. And you think the wrong you've done is just too much to be forgiven, but you know that
flying with Global Air Force.